ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, remember this old Monty Python sketch?
The sketch from The Life of Brian, where what did the Romans ever do for us? Well, there were aqueducts. Yeah, I mean, apart from aqueducts. Well, sanitation. Yeah, apart from sanitation. Apart from education.
Could that just as well be about today's liberal democracy as ancient Rome?
Can we just have a bit of that about liberal democracy? What is liberal apart from free voting, the peaceful transfer of power, due process, the rule of law, universal education? I think liberal democracy, for all its many faults, has done us quite well in this room. And I think that it just does need a bit of championing at the moment when we just want to say, oh God, it's all so shit. And then we leave it open for the populists of far right or far left to come in and tear those institutions down.
It's Natasha Mitchell. Welcome to Big Ideas with Big Thinkers at the best live events. Yes, it may be the least worst form of government, but faith in liberal democratic leaders and institutions is waning. Some are taken by its populist critics instead, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, Pauline Hanson. So have we taken the value of liberal democratic principles for granted and just let them be whittled away by powerful interests? By pure neglect? Do they need protecting? Or do they need to evolve? With his inimitable analysis, the popular host of the blockbuster The News Agents podcast, he's one of Britain's foremost journalists, John Sopel, grapples with the future of democracy today on Big Ideas, right here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Coming to you from the Sydney Writers' Festival on Gadigal land, John Sopel is a former editor for the BBC in North America, during which time he wrote a trilogy of books about Trump's America. Now he has a new one out, Strange Land, How Britain Stopped Making Sense, about his return to the UK after 8 years in the US. Co-hosting today's conversation are Rosalind Dixon, who's Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales and founder of the Resilient Democracy Lab. She's also co-authored The People's Guide to the Australian Constitution. And the voice of ABC Radio National's Saturday Extra, former BBC Washington correspondent and author of The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself, is my colleague, Nick Bryant.
Good morning and welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival. It is fantastic to see you. What a crowd, what a beautiful crowd, what a multi-generational crowd. There are young people in the house, and that is absolutely fantastic to see. My name is Nick Bryant. I'm the host of Radio National's Saturday Extra program, although I confess I did have a lie-in this morning. I'm also the author of a new Substack called History Never Ended. I called it History Never Ended because I belong to a generation of journalists who were told that history had ended. I started my career in the early 1990s. The Berlin Wall had just been demolished. The Soviet Union was disintegrating, and Francis Fukuyama wrote a seminal essay talking about the end of history and the triumph of liberal democracy. But here we are, 30 years on, talking about the future of democracy. And frankly, you could add a question mark to those few words. John, I see a lot of you in Sydney, partly because your son lives about 500 metres away from me.
Yep.
Extraordinarily. And we always get together, don't we, at a local cafe. In fact, we bumped into each other this morning, didn't we?
And you wouldn't let me hug you because you'd just come back from the gym and he was soaking wet.
So I was.
I said, fine, I won't hug you.
But you did buy me a flat white, but sadly we couldn't sit down and enjoy those flat whites because I was rushing to get here. But if we had sat down at the table, and often we have these conversations that last about an hour, don't we? And we think that would have made a pretty good podcast if you sort of edited out the bits about BBC gossip.
Yeah.
But I think the question I would have asked you this morning if we had sat down is, what the hell is happening in Britain?
It's all going very well. honestly, Britain has lost its mind. I think we've all lost our mind. Keir Starmer is the Prime Minister, I think. Shall I just check that on my phone?
No, you have to check your phone.
Yeah, and you do need to check your phone. And I was getting updates when it looked like there was going to be a coup and whether a cabinet was going to move against him. He hasn't been Prime Minister 2 years. A kind of pointless little statistic I'll give you now. The last Prime Minister to come to power through winning an election and leaving power through losing an election, which you would think is the democratic norm in our liberal democracy, was 1970 to 1974. Half a century ago, it is, and that was Edward Heath, who came to power by winning an election and lost power by losing one. Ever since then, there have been coups, there have been plots, there have been leadership campaigns, and it hasn't been just left to the people to decide. And so, when I wrote Strangeland, I'd just come back from living in America. It's 2022. And for the first three decades of my voting life, from sort of 1979 onwards, there were three prime ministers in 28 years. And in 2022, we got through three in 1 year. So do I give Keir Starmer's chances much for survival? Not a huge amount at the moment. And if he's still there at Christmas, I'll be surprised.
I mean, what's particularly striking is that he didn't only win an election a couple of years ago. He won a landslide. He won an absolutely massive landslide. But now it looks like Westminster has replaced Canberra as the kind of coup capital of the democratic world. If the ashes were decided on prime ministerial instability...
God, if only that was the case. If only that was the case, we'd have more of a chance.
But John, I was asking you before we came on about whether you thought this would happen, and you were suggesting you don't think Keir Starmer's really that good a prime minister. So you say we've gone mad, but, he's a man without real relatability. Britain is in the, transition from Brexit, massive cost of living problems, strikes, a sense of, needing to find a new sense of itself, and he's not providing it. He also managed to appoint an ambassador with ties to Epstein. So surely the people are the ones who are sane, and it's the leaders who aren't stepping up.
I think that's fair. I think that there is also... Look, I think that Keir Starmer... You're right, won a landslide, but it was a sort of loveless landslide. I think it was...
Desperate landslide.
It was that people just had enough of the circus of the Conservatives, endlessly changing leader, some of the deceit that went on over Brexit and the great things that would come from it, which have never yet arrived. And I think people had just had enough. And so I don't think people thought, oh my God, Keir Starmer is the future, in the way that maybe they did, and just talking in the British example now, that they did when they embraced Thatcher in 79 or when they embraced Blair in 97, that this seemed like something Britain needed to change and this is going to be the agent of that change. Keir Starmer came in promising that politics would become a lot quieter in people's lives, and instead of which it's just been as noisy, there's been as much psychodrama, and he's really not a good communicator. If you say to him, so what do you want to do with you being Prime Minister? What do you want to make Britain be? What's the story? He would say, well, I think very slow incrementalism. And that just doesn't sound very exciting. And, when people are still struggling with the cost of living crisis, he's made a lot of very bad decisions that he's then had to U-turn on. You're absolutely right, the chaos around what happened over the appointment of our ambassador to Washington, former Minister Peter Mandelson. And, Peter Mandelson turned out to be a pretty bad dude in a lot of what he had done and had lied about. But then Keir Starmer was trying to blame everybody else for the decision. I don't think that looked good. And I just think he's fallen so far short of what people expected. But I think the other side of it is that there is an expectation now in politics, and I think this is the bigger question of democracy, which we should come to, which is that I think people think there are instant solutions to really complicated problems. Mm. And I just don't think there are. And I think that I think people have, listened to, maybe Nigel Farage in Britain or Pauline Hanson here or others around the world who just kind of go on and say, well, if only we did that, then all your lives would be better. We sort of got that with Brexit, and it hasn't turned out to be like that. And I think there is that disillusionment with conventional politics, and that is why people are prepared now to embrace previously unthinkable ideas.
As you say, Keir Starmer didn't even get to check into the honeymoon suite, did he? Let alone put on the white fluffy toweling robe. Having
You've
been the
benefic- watching too much Married at First Sight, mate.
I mean, having been the beneficiary of anti-incumbency, he immediately became the victim of anti-incumbency, it seemed, from afar. And as you say, that raises the larger question. Has Britain become ungovernable? Does the democratic world face a crisis of governance at the moment? And if so, what's caused it? Is it the media's desperate need for politicians with journalistic entertainment value, like Donald Trump, like Pauline Hanson, like Nigel Farage? Is it the social media world that has speeded up politics? What's going on?
I think there are elements of all of that in that. And you could go on to X or Insta or TikTok or whatever it happens to be and think that that is the real world, where everyone is in a rage the whole time. And you measure that against your own lives and you think, well, no, actually, I'm kind of quite mild-mannered and I'm kind of normal. And I think that politicians have decided that truth and reality resides on X and it doesn't. And, you know, we saw that in Britain. There was a terrible case a couple of years ago in Southport where three little kids got murdered. It was initially said that word went around on the internet that it was a Muslim refugee or someone who'd come into the country illegally. That wasn't the case. And then there are riots and the mosque is burnt down. And it becomes headlines and Elon Musk is putting up on X that a civil war has come to Britain. It was inevitable and now it's arrived. Well, the last time I looked in Britain, we were not in a state of civil war. I mean, there are tensions, there are problems in our society and all the rest of it. X would have you believe that Britain was coming apart at the seams, that Sharia law had been imposed across the country. The next day after those riots, without the fanfare, without the attention, people are there with brushes and brooms and they're clearing up the mess and they're trying to repair the mosque and they're trying to, you know, replace the windows that have been smashed. And I thought, actually, that's the Britain. So you could judge the Britain and say, well, there were 50,000 people, I don't know, protesting about Palestine and what Israel was doing in Gaza on the streets in London, and that reflects real opinion. There were 67 million people who weren't. And I think that we sometimes are distracted by those who make the most noise.
John, in terms of what comes next, I mean, if it's social media, we're in big trouble, right? Because how we deal with that is really a global problem. And
you're trying to make a go at it here in Australia.
But by stopping 15-year-olds going on Instagram rather than Russia, you know, hack into elections. So we've taken a small step, but I still think we're tackling the smallest part of what is a massive problem. But what about the fact that our politicians aren't giving us what we want, right? So part of the problem with the Starmers of the world is, you know, they're dry technocrat and incremental. Rishi Sunak was no different. You've got tectonic change on technology, AI, globalisation, climate, a sense of economic exclusion. And isn't it that we need better politicians and leaders who can articulate what that looks like? I mean, if Keir Starmer goes, the guy who might get his seat is a mayor from Liverpool, Andy Burman, you know, much more capable of articulating a vision that people can get behind. Mamdani in the United States, you know, defied the odds. Isn't there a need for a fresh new vision for the left or the centre-right that can actually speak to people and the absolute tectonic shifts that we're facing, and that it's not politics that's ungovernable, it's that the leaders haven't stepped up to the challenge we face?
Yeah, I am aware that what I'm going to say now leads me open to the accusation that I have a severe case of old fart syndrome. And I apologise for that in advance. But I sometimes do look at the ministers that we've got in our government and I compare them to some of the people of the centre-left and of the centre-right who were there when I was growing up. And I think they're pretty insubstantial. You know, they leave Oxford University with a degree in politics, philosophy and economics, probably like you. And
except they got a 2-1.
Yeah. And then they go and work as a researcher for an MP, and then they go and work for a trade union, and then they find a seat to... And they've never done a job in the real world, and they've got no real life experience. And they come in, and then they kind of sort of make a hash of big economic decisions because they've never run a business. They've got no kind of worldly experience. But then I, you know, and that's me with my old fart syndrome. And then I think, who in their right minds would want to go into politics right now where your head is being shot off, where you are being accused of this, that, and the other, and it is such a toxic environment that you then end up with people who are a little bit weird wanting to go into politics. I do think there is an interesting analysis to be done on the politician as the outsider. I mean, because if you look back at British prime ministers, there aren't many that are that normal. I mean, maybe Blair, but he's a bit messianic. Cameron, but, you know, Boris, Liz Truss, for all 49 days that she was prime minister.
This was kind of normal.
No, she was absolutely not. Bonkers. Nutty, you know, as a fruitcake.
As the youth voice on the stage, I would say, I run this program.
What do you mean? It's getting feisty up here.
I run a program called the Pathways to Politics for Women program in New South Wales, and they're extremely normal women from diverse backgrounds who are wanting to make change in their community. So I do think we often select for people who, you know, are a little odd and a little problematic. But there are people who are willing to take the hate because they see what needs to change.
Yes, and I absolutely salute. It's, you know, look, there's an old line about journalists, the relationship between a journalist and a politician. I think it was H.L. Mencken who said, the relationship between a journalist and a politician should be the same as that between a dog and a lamppost. And I think that... And I think that's kind of really glib, because I actually think that a lot of politicians are going into it because they want to make their country, their community, their environment, all the rest of it better. And they start with very noble intentions. Yeah, they're about power. Yeah, they're about winning elections. Yeah, they're, you know, backbiting and conniving and all the stuff that goes on in politics. But I, broadly speaking, like politicians. And I think that, frankly, if I hadn't been such a coward, you know, I might have, instead of throwing stones... As a journalist, which we do, would I have gone there and become a politician myself?
It's not too late, John.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's too late.
On this stage tonight, you could announce your candidacy for the Prime Ministership of the UK. Yeah.
Well, look, at the rate we're going, everyone gets a term.
You stand a pretty good chance.
I think that there is a problem in the quality of people that are coming forward. And I think that maybe the public are being unrealistic in terms of the expectation of what can be delivered. And I do think there is an economic side of this, and this applies, I think, around the world. And that is, you know, in our lifetimes, I don't think we've lived through anything quite like the 2008 financial crash, which has had such a long tail. And the tail only started to having an effect in sort of 2016 when, you know, Donald Trump gets elected in Washington, Britain votes for Brexit. You know, we're suddenly, you know, it's not been uncommon for people before an election to go up to the edge of this stage, peer over it and think, oh, I'm not, too scary, and take three steps back. And in 2016, it was like everyone wanted to jump. Okay, I don't care. I am prepared to do something that is kind of abnormal and dangerous. And people have not seen their living standards rise. The inheritance for Keir Starmer was appalling because of the, you know, a mixture of the 2008 financial crash, COVID, the war in Ukraine with the effect that it's had on energy prices. And so the inheritance has been terrible for conventional politicians. What you do need, and this is where I think you're absolutely right when you raise about the sort of Zora Mamdani in New York or Andy Burnham, who's the mayor of Greater Manchester, but grew up in Liverpool, is that these are people who've got a power base in a kind of discrete geographical area where charisma and personal charm has helped them win through. And I think you do need, you know, look, if there's a lesson...
And brave policy.
Yeah, and bravery. And that if there is a lesson from Donald Trump, and there are many lessons that are in the kind of negative direction of Donald Trump, it's that you need to have people who can project, who understand that we live in an attention economy. Can you gain people's attention? Can you tell them a story? Have you got a narrative of what you want to do with politics and what your ideas are and what the arguments are that you need to make? Because often, I think with Keir Starmer, he just wants to avoid argument. Well, I'm sorry, if you're going to say, right, we need to do X or Y on welfare or defence spending, make the argument for it. Have that fight. You know, politics should be a battle of ideas. And Keir Starmer is very proud of the fact that there is no such thing as Starmerism. There is just a series of pragmatic kind of responses to whatever the problem is. So what's it all about? And that's his problem.
One of our Slido commenters, just echoing Stephen Nugent, was saying it's not only about have the arguments, tell the story.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of thought that in 2016, when Nick and I were covering the Trump election, you know, Donald Trump had these fantastic headlines. Build a wall, you know, keep Muslims out. You know, argue about it, but it was pretty clear what he wanted to do. Renegotiate trade deals, make America great again, drain the swamp. There were clear ideas. And when I had to go on television, Nick had to go on TV, and we were asked, so what are Hillary Clinton's main policy priorities? She didn't, you know, Donald Trump had a top line every time for everything. And Hillary Clinton had lines 2, 3, 4, and 5, but you couldn't articulate what she was for. Donald Trump told a story to the American people, and in 2016, he won that election fair and square with drain the swamp, build the wall, you know, I think he did. I think he absolutely did.
The power of the three-word slogan in politics, hey? On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, we're with John Sopel, Nick Bryant and Rosalind Dixon today from the stage of the Sydney Writers' Festival, with this event co-hosted by the Resilient Democracy Lab at the University of New South Wales, exploring the future of democracy such as it is. And hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have you along. Continuing with Donald Trump next.
I'm going to take you back to the night that he won. We were sat next to each other, weren't we?
We were.
We were at the Jacob Javits Convention Center in Manhattan. They'd constructed a stage underneath this massive glass ceiling that figuratively Hillary Clinton was going to shatter. And then the early results started coming through, didn't they, John, from Florida? They didn't look good for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So we're suddenly looking at Miami-Dade and Broward County and we're thinking, oh, Christ, are we in the right place? Because it doesn't look like Hillary Clinton. And my wife, who's in the audience somewhere, she'd come out with our daughter, Anna. And Linda wanted to bring Anna out to see this piece of history of the first woman president of the United States of America. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, Hillary Clinton's chief of staff came in and said, "Well, everyone go home. You're not going to see Hillary Clinton tonight."
It was an extraordinary moment, wasn't it? I've never known a press room like it.
Yeah.
Because people who were paid to speak for a living and people who were paid to write for a living were speechless and could not come up with words. I think we were both shell-shocked, weren't we? And then we had to kick in, obviously, when a deadline starts emerging. Yeah. But I think a lot about that night, and I think about what was it we missed? You know, I've ended up writing a couple of books about what we've missed, and to me it was a kind of 50 years of history beforehand and subsequently 250 years of history beforehand. But going back to what you were saying about the economy, I wonder to what extent a broken economy has led to a broken politics. You go back to the end of history argument, there was even a utopianism around that we weren't going to have recessions anymore, that the internet would save us from recessionary cycles, that the internet would bring us together in these online civic town squares where we'd have this very sensible and helpful discussions. None of that happened. I wonder what extent the previous sort of 20 years and the economic trends have laid the seedbed for Trumpism, for Brexit, you know, even here in Australia, for the rise of Pauline Hanson.
Well, you go back to Fukuyama, and it was, of course, you know, the start of globalization. The BRIC economies, the G20, all these countries that were going to have a burgeoning middle class. And everyone thought, well, this is fantastic, because then we can sell our goods to those countries as well. And then the supply chains were getting longer and longer and longer. And what you were seeing was that an awful lot of jobs were being offshored. And so jobs that had been in America, call centers, well, what we could do that in the Philippines, or we could do that in Mexico, or we could do that somewhere else. And, well, you know, making Levi jeans. Well, do we need to do that in Georgia? Well, no, we can do that in Vietnam. And what about steel production? Well, let's do that in South Korea. We don't need steel mills in Pennsylvania where we have to pay people a lot of money. So let's move those steel mills. And what happened at the 2008 financial crash, which was different from previous recessions that we'd seen, was that normally in a recession, everyone expects, okay, well, I'm unemployed, but I'll be back in work in a year's time, and the steel mill will reopen, and the textile plant will reopen, and the call centers will reopen. And they didn't. And I think that is what led to the massive disillusionment, which has led to politics getting broken, as you describe it, and is the seedbed for Donald Trump, who brilliantly... I met Don Jr. in...
Are you going to the wedding?
Hang on, let me just check the invitation. Yeah. I haven't got the invitation yet. I met Don Jr. at one of these huge out-of-town churches in Iowa, just outside Des Moines. And he said to me, the thing you have to understand about my father is that he's just a blue-collar worker. And then he paused, but with a better bank balance. And I thought initially it was a preposterous thing to say. And actually, Trump's genius, I think, in 2016, was to speak to the concerns of people who thought that Obama liberalism had gone way too far and we'd become too woke as a country, and that, you know, illegal immigration had been allowed to get out of control, and all those things that Trump campaigned on. He had a real sense of where public mood is. I think at the moment, actually, and I think this is kind of vaguely reassuring, I think he's sounding increasingly out of touch with ordinary Americans and their lives as he enriches himself still further in the most unbelievable way that has been taking place in this second presidency.
Mm. I've spoken of the Hormuz paradox, that right now you are seeing the consequences of a populist nationalist who does crazy stuff, like launch a war in the Middle East without really thinking of the economic consequences of it. You know, he didn't realise that it would lead to the shuttering of the Strait of Hormuz. He didn't realise
that... He probably didn't know where the Strait of Hormuz was.
Exactly. And if he did, he'd call it the Strait of Trump. He'd want to rename it. He didn't think through the economic consequences of that. And yet, at that very moment that we are seeing the results of a kind of populism gone mad in America, populism is on the rise in Britain. Populism is on the rise here in Australia. Literally that same time. You know, the One Nation Party here has done very well in elections in South Australia and won a by-election, its first ever seat that it's won in the Australian Parliament through an election. I'm struck by the sort of paradox of that. We're seeing the sort of what a kind of Trump's destructive politics can do, a kind of tear down everything sort of politics, and yet it still has appeal internationally.
It does, and you talk about kind of Britain, Australia, we could add France into the mix, we could add Germany into the mix, we could add the Netherlands into the mix. You know, all those countries have seen that sort of right-wing populism. In Britain, we're also seeing a sort of left-wing populism with the growth of the Green Party as well. And I think that, you know, I'll tell you something really interesting, though. And that was that, you know, I don't know how many of you know Nigel Farage, who's the leader of the Reform Party in the UK, the sort of far-right party there, anti-immigration party. He's clever. He's a very smart operator. He's a brilliant communicator. When we talk about politicians who can tell a story, he is very, very good at that. And so, you know, that makes him a very consequential figure and someone you can't ignore. I heard him on the radio the other morning. We had municipal elections in the UK a couple of weeks back, which were a catastrophe for the Labour Party, but not great for the Conservatives either. And Reform and the Green Party did really well. Nigel Farage was on the radio and he was talking about, we've got to learn the lessons about illegal immigration from America, and we've got to deal with the fact that there are illegal immigrants in our country, and there is one president who has done a fantastic job on getting rid of the illegal immigrants, and you're waiting for the punchline, Donald Trump, and the punchline was Barack Obama. He said Barack Obama was the genius in dealing all of this. And I suddenly thought, what, Farage is saying Obama is the gene. What's going on here? And it sort of scrambles your head. Why? Even though he is so close to Donald Trump, he knows that Donald Trump is radioactive in Britain. And so for him, you've got populists now trying to distance themselves from the grandfather of populism, Donald Trump. Mm. And I find that absolutely fascinating. So they're having to redefine what populism is, because the example from the United States of America, people are looking at in Europe and thinking, God, no. You know, and you talk about, you know, the kind of wading into this war in Iran. And Trump is losing his mind on Truth Social at the moment for the criticism that he's getting. And he says, we've won. Well, if you've won, why is the Strait of Hormuz still shut, which was open beforehand? And they have got themselves into such a mess. And, you know, it's almost worse than George W. Bush in 2003, where he's, you know, it's easy to start a war and very, very difficult to stop one.
Especially when you're, you know, negotiating with a regime that doesn't really have, you know, a coherent body to negotiate with. But what do you think it means for the midterms, John? Because Trump obviously wants to declare the conflict over for a range of reasons, but most notably because if he goes into November with the Strait of Hormuz closed, he's in big trouble. I guess there's three possibilities. One is he's very motivated to actually try and get a deal. The second is he will cancel the midterms. And the third is that he doesn't care about Congress because he just does everything by decree anyway, and so Congress is irrelevant. What's your prediction for November?
Those are a fabulous range of scenarios there. I don't think he cancels. I don't think he can.
Well, of course he can.
No,
I'm a constitutional lawyer.
No, I don't think he can. I think, I think...
Tell us about the Constitution.
He just has to suspend things. You know, it's what dictators do all around the world. They say there's an emergency, there's a war, there's an economic emergency. We're suspending the Constitution and elections, and we'll get back to you when things get back to normal, which, of course, they never will under President Trump.
I just don't believe that scenario. I think there are other...
I didn't say it's likely. I said it's possible.
No, it's possible. Okay. The election went on in 1944 when America was in the middle of the Second World War. It's up to states to run their local elections. So the Supreme Court would get... Under the Constitution. But it would... I think that there are certain lines where the Supreme Court, even though it's got a 6-3 Conservative majority, would say... No, the elections have to go ahead. I think there are other ways.
Well, Gorsuch, Coney Barrett and Roberts might prove you right, so let's hope.
Yeah, so there are others. There are other ways that he affects. And what we saw, I don't know whether you followed it, though I'm sure you did, what was happening in Minneapolis, where the ICE officers suddenly appear on the streets and, you know, sir, I'm arresting you on suspicion of being brown. That I've got no other means to, but you're a bit dark, you're not quite white enough, and therefore you're under arrest and you've got to prove that you're an American citizen. And what happened there was grotesque. And I think that there were an awful lot of people who just really balked at that and said, this is going too far. And I'm sure that Minneapolis was the experiment that the White House wanted to run ahead of the midterm elections. Because you could say, right, we think that in this electoral district, where Democrats have historically relied on Hispanic votes to win, we're just going to have a lot of ICE officers with their guns outside the polling districts, and you can come and vote by all means, but we'll be there and we'll be checking your papers. Who wants to go and be cross-examined for 20 minutes by an ICE officer before you go and vote? So you could suppress the turnout, and I still think that that might happen. That's one way of doing it. The redistricting that has been taking place and redistricting. So you kind of recarve the parameters of a constituency or an electoral district so that, you know, for example, you might have a really safe seat where there's a very high African-American population and that will always vote Democrat. And what you do is you get rid of that district altogether and put it into more suburban districts where there's it becomes a very heavily white district, and you just take away a Democrat seat. And that has been going on wholesale at the moment in America. Now, the Democrats are hitting back, and notably in California, they've tried to do that. Virginia, they've tried to do that, but it's failed. That's another scenario. But then the consequences of failure. I think that Donald Trump will have passed the high water mark of his power come the midterms, because I don't think he runs again. I think the 22nd Amendment is... I'm hesitant now about anything to do with the Constitution, because I know I'm going to be in trouble. I don't think that happens. I'll give you another scenario which you didn't point out, and this goes to the kind of, you know, I think Nick and I have probably spent far, far too much time trying to get inside Donald Trump's head and how that crazy brain works. Isn't there another scenario where Donald Trump would quite like the Republicans to lose, that you can't win without my name on the ticket, that I'm the only one who really is the election winner, and look, you're all absolutely lost without me, and but for me, you'd be nowhere, and you owe everything to me? And I think that there is an element in which I think he would take quiet satisfaction from getting a shellacking, as the phrase that Obama used over a set of midterm elections, for that to happen. So I think that that is possible too.
The future for the Republican Party in the US and what that means for its democracy, with host of the Newsagents podcast, John Sopel, whose new book is called Strangeland, How Britain Stopped Making Sense, on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. You're with me, Natasha Mitchell, coming to you from the Sydney Writers Festival today. This event is co-hosted by the University of New South Wales's law professor, Rosalind Dixon, and my ABC Radio National colleague, host of Saturday Extra, Nick Bryant.
I want to talk about the future of democracy in America. I also want to make an important point. I mean, democracy actually produced Donald Trump. I mean, he won two elections, fair and square.
Yep.
The first election he won without winning the nationwide vote, but he won through the Electoral College, and that's a legitimate victory. The second election he won was emphatic. He won all the battleground states. He won a clear victory, not only in the Electoral College, but in the nationwide popular vote as well. I mean, you know, Nigel Farage's Reform UK, I mean, it's people voting for them that is putting in power. I think it's a key point to make. This is democracy in action. It may not
Can
be...
Can we also say that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election fair and square as well, even though he continues to deny it?
And that was what I was going to bring on to, because we were there for January the 6th, the storming of the US Capitol, an insurrection that was led and instigated by a sitting US president. But, John, it's not just that Trump is mounting an assault on democracy. There are other players as well. The Supreme Court recently, which has led to this frenzy of gerrymandering in the American South, they gutted again the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is so important because it was the act that actually brought about universal suffrage in America. It's remarkable. It took until the mid-1960s to have genuine universal suffrage in America. John, I mean, I don't just worry about what Trump's doing to American democracy. I worry about what a lot of players are doing to American democracy. Do you share those concerns?
Look, I think that anyone who thinks that liberal democracy, whether in America or here, or Britain, or Europe, is here to stay, that it's immutable, that it's a permanent feature of our lives, is being unbelievably complacent. I think if we want to keep and maintain and foster a strong liberal democracy, then you've got to fight for it. And the lesson of 2020, as you say, we were there on January the 6th, was not how robust, which is what some American storytellers would have you believe, that this wasn't an exercise in how robust the US Constitution is and how tough it is and how it can resist the likes of Donald Trump and anyone else. You know, when I went on live television on the 10 o'clock news up for our main nightly news bulletin that evening on the January the 6th, when Joe Biden's result should have been certified, the mob was still in control of Congress. And I said then, and it was a line I never thought I would use ever in a broadcast, but, you know, you've got to worry about American democracy tonight because the mob was still in control and Joe Biden's victory had not been certified. What saved American democracy then was a few good people who were prepared to stand up. You know, a guy called Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, who was the Secretary of State there, who said, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Trump, you lost that election. You haven't got those 11,780 votes or whatever it is. They don't exist. We've checked. You lost. The Vice President, Mike Pence, saying, no, I have to certify Joe Biden's election victory. I cannot not do it. Donald Trump and those around him were willing people to break the Constitution, and it was but for the actions of a few good men and women who were prepared to stand up and say no. The idea that the system of checks and balances and that it was the durability of the Constitution is just wrong, and therefore you kind of worry what could happen in the future.
Arithmetic was also crucial that day, wasn't it? The fact that Nancy Pelosi was the House Speaker. The Democrats had the numbers to actually certify that election. If the Republicans had the numbers not to certify that election, there's every possibility they would not have certified it. And to make the point, what you were saying on the 10 o'clock news that night, that would have been, 5 o'clock in Washington. That night, after the insurrectionists had been dispersed, the next wave of the attack on democracy had happened, because Republican lawmakers who just a few hours before had run for their lives, went back into that chamber, and many of them, I think it was 168 of them, voted to reject the results of the election. And then afterwards, in the months afterwards, Republican-controlled state houses carried out even more laws to restrict minority voting rights in the states. This isn't an attack on democracy that ended that afternoon.
And to anatomize that and just break that down a bit further, of the 168 Republicans in the House who didn't vote to certify Joe Biden's victory, my guess is that 150, 155 of those 168 absolutely knew, without a shadow of doubt, that Joe Biden had won fair and square. There were maybe a dozen who were diehard Trump acolytes who thought that the election had been stolen, that the voting machines were switching votes from Trump, you know, to Biden, and it was all down to those pesky voting machines. Everyone knew that Biden had won. But the terror of Donald Trump and the damage that he could do to them, either by going after them on social media and shame, naming and shaming, by which time you're going to receive death threats, or more powerfully, that if you come after me, I'm coming after you, and you're going to be face a primary challenger. And in the past 2 weeks, we have still seen the immense power that Donald Trump wields over the Republican Party. So that, you know, there was a congressman from Kentucky called Thomas Massie. He's been outed because he had resisted Trump. Senator from Louisiana, Bill Cassidy, who had voted for Trump's impeachment at the impeachment trial after January the 6th, he's out. Anyone who has crossed Donald Trump, and the Department of Justice is waging a war of vengeance against anyone who has criticized him, because that is what the president wants. And I also should just say, when we're being fearful about democracy, some of the fascistic symbols of regimes that you think have gone in history are appearing in Washington now. There is a huge banner of Donald Trump hanging down from the Department of Justice. Hang on, the Department of Justice is meant to be independent of the president. It's meant to be one of the checks and balances. The judiciary is meant to, you know, there's meant to be an arm's length between Attorney General. And it's not happening. And just this week, there was a whole complicated case that Donald Trump sued his own government for $10 billion over the fact that his tax returns got leaked a few years ago. And there's been a settlement of that, which has kind of... But the Attorney General then issued an edict a couple of days ago saying that from now on and in future, neither Donald Trump nor his son's tax returns can be audited ever again. Hang on. So I can fill in my tax return and say income none, gifts none, tax due none. And you can't audit it? Yep, that's it. So Donald Trump and his kids, and let's face it, the self-enriching that has been going on in this presidency is off the scale. That has just been enshrined by the acting attorney general, a guy called Todd Blanche, who, he used to be Donald Trump's personal lawyer.
So, John, I have two thoughts. One is just to go back to the story that you tell in Unprecedented about sort of heroism, really, ordinary people being really brave. And you tell us that really it's all about personal courage and not a lot about institutions. I think maybe that underplays the importance of contingency, as Nick said, personal courage and institutions as an important mix. You know, you guys were in Washington, I was on the Central Coast on January 6th.
No, we're out of rather been.
I wrote a piece in the New York Times. I had the advantage of everyone being asleep in the United States, and I wrote the first piece in the world calling for the removal and impeachment of Donald Trump with my co-author David Landau. And I do believe that if Pence had fallen and we had got closer to a true constitutional crisis, there might have been a mix of leadership and institutions in removal and impeachment that might have done some work. And I do think we need to be mindful. I mean, when it comes to the Supreme Court, you're willing to believe in them. I do think that we have to think about, especially in the Australian context, defending our institutions, even though they're kind of dry and boring at arm's length. Personal courage plus leadership plus institutions, I think, are critically important. And you see that around the world in when democracy holds, it's a mix of the institutions and the people.
Yeah, and absolutely. Roz, I think that is so right. And I think that, you know, we're in danger of taking some of the institutions that we have, which we love to moan about, and rightly, because we live in a democracy, for granted. And I am endlessly reminded, I saw on, I think, Instagram the other day, someone had posted the sketch from Monty Python, and the younger people that Nick was pointing out, and of course, Roz, you're much younger than myself, us, as you've also pointed out. The sketch from The Life of Brian, where what did the Romans ever do for us? Well, there were aqueducts. Yeah, I mean, apart from aqueducts. Well, sanitation. Yeah, apart from sanitation. Apart from education. Can we just have a bit of that about liberal democracy? What is liberal democracy? Apart from free voting, the peaceful transfer of power, due process, the rule of law, universal education. I think liberal democracy, for all its many faults, has done us quite well in this room. And I think that it just does need a bit of championing at the moment when we just want to say, oh, God, it's all so shit. And then we leave it open for the populists of far right or far left to come in and tear those institutions down.
But need to be careful, because you have a house, and when we say to young people it's all great and they worry about climate change and they worry about access to the economy, I think it's really important that democracy is declining in support fastest among young people. So it's about teaching them about their traditions. There's a question here from one of our audience about young people, and I think they are, you know, needing to understand the traditions and what makes them better, but also to have politicians that can speak to their concerns.
So in Britain, my generation, the old fart generation, are really well protected by public policy. There is something called a triple lock on pensions, where pensions will always rise. I get free prescriptions because I'm over 60 now. I get a free bus and rail pass because I'm over 60 now. You know, everything is geared in our democracies to the over 60s, because they tend to go out and vote. And I know you've got compulsory voting in Australia. Whereas young people, yeah, I know, they always say they're going to vote, but they never bloody well do. So why should we have any public policy that supports them? I think it's an enormous mistake that public policy has to change so that young people feel they've got a stake in our society and they've got a way out of generation rent, and maybe they'll get a foot on the housing ladder or whatever it happens to be. And there's just too little of that among the policymakers, of politicians who think that there's no point trying to make policies for young people because they're never going to vote for me, so let's just keep the old wrinklies like me happy and everything's going to be okay. Sorry.
So talking of people, you know, thinking about their retirement...
Did I say I was thinking about my retirement?
No.
Are you suggesting I should be?
You're running for the Prime Ministership of the UK.
Old wrinklies. You said before that you're confident that Trump's going to go and that maybe there's a small part of him that would love to see the Republicans lose without him. But what about the fact that if he goes, he will be prosecuted by all number of state officials and the next president of the United States if they're a Democrat? And I think that perhaps the sort of view from prison is not quite as rosy as the view from Mar-a-Lago. And I do want to press you on what might happen if we have another January 6th.
So another January the 6th is a nightmare prospect. I think that he's not going to prison. I mean, the Supreme Court has made a ruling now that he more or less has immunity for everything he does.
In his official capacity.
And you can define that in the broadest terms possible. So, you know, it was in his official capacity that he was trying to overturn the results in Georgia. It was in his official capacity that he squirreled away confidential documents in boxes at Mar-a-Lago.
But so opening a golf course in Vietnam as a quid pro quo for a trade deal with his son may or may not be. So, yes, it's going to be hard, but I think...
I also think that the Democrats now look back and think about the prosecutions that were brought. And this is a really... And this gets to a fundamental question about democracy and the law and those who break the law. I think you would have to say that if you look back, that the attempted prosecutions of Donald Trump over Stormy Daniels and the money that was received, and in the New York court case, the Georgia court case, the attempted case that was being brought over Mar-a-Lago, was dynamite for Donald Trump. It gave him strength. He suddenly was able to position himself as, oh my God, if the American legal system comes after me and can get me, what about you? You don't stand a chance. I am all that stands between you and an overmighty state. And I think it made Donald Trump more powerful, more popular, more a victim, and he always was able to lean into victimhood.
A shared sense of victimhood helped explain that paradox, didn't it, of how a New York billionaire became a working class hero in the Rust Belt. He could say to them, they've looked down at me in the same way they looked down at you. I want to just bring it back to Australia in the last 5 minutes we have, John. You spend quite a lot of time here now. You get to observe Australian politics. I wonder, you look at our system of democracy here. It's often called the Westminster model. I think that phrase should be retired because it's nothing like democracy in the UK. We have compulsory voting here. We have preferential voting here. We have weekend voting here. There's this lovely thing called the democracy sausage that people sink their teeth into.
The democracy sausage?
An elected Senate?
John doesn't know about the democracy sausage. Oh, goodness me. John,
Do you put mustard on it, or...?
Oh, well, that's the thing. It's a democracy, John. You get to choose. I just wonder... I see a lot of reporting that's saying, the rise of Pauline Hanson shows that populism has come to Australia. Well, it came to Australia in the late 1990s. In many ways, Pauline Hanson was preemptive. A lot of things in Australian politics have been preemptive. New Labour was a bit of a rip-off of Keating and Hawke. Everybody's in the Conservative Party is looking to ape John Howard's immigration policies. Pauline Hanson was saying things about immigration, political correctness, and globalisation in the late 1990s that really provided a script for people like Donald Trump. So it's nothing new that it's come here, but I wonder whether there are safeguards here, John, that you see in a uniquely Australian model of democracy.
I'm sort of going to hesitate on this because I think for me to start talking kind of knowledgeably about Australian politics would be me wading well out of my depth, particularly with you two on the stage, and I'm going to be corrected. I'm kind of fascinating to watch the sort of rambunctious nature of Australian politics. And, it's not the Westminster model. We're aping your model, it seems, with the coups against the endless prime ministers and the like. And so, it was Keir Starmer looking at Albanese, the Labour, it used to be the other way round. And now we've got, British politics is looking to conservatives, to the way Australian politics is done, sorry. And you look at the person who was advising Boris Johnson, Australian, Linton Crosby.
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, and all those people. So we are trying to learn from Australian politics. I've always been sort of ambivalent on the idea of compulsory voting.
Don't be.
Me too.
Yeah, but
until I lived in America and came back. Yeah.
I think that the idea that politicians have to address their remarks to everybody. So, for example, what we were talking about a moment ago about how public policy in the UK is so skewed towards older people is based on the assumption that younger people don't vote. And if you suddenly think the whole population has got to vote, then maybe you have to tailor your policies for the whole population, which might not be a bad thing. And that might encourage people to go out and have the policies that people need and want. And I think that, too often the mistakes that the reason why populism has may be developed is that sometimes, some of the liberals who may live in Sydney or Melbourne are not speaking the same language as people who live in maybe rural areas. And, and there has been a backlash against, in America. I thought that Trump's slogan was one of those powerful election slogans in 2024, when it was sort of against, it was the toll trans issue and whether people thought that policy had gone mad. And every Saturday during college football, and college football is huge in America. You know, my experience of university football in England was that, you know, there'd be a parent with a dog, now a Labrador, and maybe a couple of girlfriends watching the football match. There'd be five people. And, you know, the Crimson Tide game, there'll be 100,000 people in these amazing stadiums for college. And Donald Trump ran these adverts during college football, which were just with the slogan, Kamala Harris is for them, they, Donald Trump is for you. And I think that, you know, for politicians to be conscious of where people's are is not a bad thing to have to be.
Well, Professor Annika Gowder at UTS and I have an article in this big collection that looks around the world, and we say compulsory voting, the AEC and preferential voting are the most important ingredients of why we're doing better. So if you're Australia and you're Penny Wong and thinking about the future, you've got to worry, should I count on the subs or not? What does America look like beyond Trump? Can MAGA outlive Trump, John?
MAGA outlives Trump for a period. There is no way that the next Republican candidate for the presidency is going to be one of those reassuring Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush type figures. They
Nikki
are
Haley.
Nikki Haley, who I actually interviewed Nikki Haley a week or two ago, and I was told I wasn't, all my questions I had to submit beforehand. I'm talking out of school now. And every reference to Donald Trump was taken out of all the questions. And like, she just didn't want to go there. Actually, when she was on stage, it was completely, I think it was her minders who did all that. And she was very happy to engage. But I don't think she stands a chance. I think that those people are, it's a generation away before, I think the Republicans will have to lose a couple of elections. And undoubtedly, look, MAGA isn't MAGA without Trump. But the values and beliefs of that will carry on. And I just don't think that a Marco Rubio or a J.D. Vance is going to be able to marshal the sort of votes that Donald Trump was able to harvest.
Nick wants to say some final words of thanks that have a little bit of a MAGA theme to them.
Oh, are you going to do a Donald Trump impression?
The air traffic control is saying we do have to land plane. But as we make our final approach, John, I mean, I spoke earlier about how we always meet up in the same cafe. And I walked into the cafe recently and I was slightly taken aback by the sort of merch they had. They had all these red caps on the walls. And I thought, oh my God, my local cafe has gone MAGA. We've got to make America great again. Takeover. But no, they've actually come up with their own merch. And I thought I'd buy you a red cap. And it's got the word Favloza on it because that's where we always meet for a coffee. And the word Favloza, obviously in English, means fabulous. And John, you've been fabulous today. So thank you, my friend. There is your red cap.
You wear yours.
I got one too. We can wear them together whenever we go for a coffee.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Now, where can I get one of those red hats, Nick? With thanks to the equally fabulous Dr. Nick Bryant, host of ABC Radio National's Saturday Extra, John Sopel, host of the News Agent podcast, that global hit. Read his new book, it's called Strangeland, How Britain Stopped Making Sense, and Rosalind Dixon is UNSW Professor of Law, founder of the Resilient Democracy Lab. Her new book is called The People's Guide to the Australian Constitution, co-authored with William Partlett. With thanks to the wonderful Sydney Writers Festival team for that event. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Hey, email me, bigideas@abc.net.au is how to get in touch. Thanks for your company today. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.